I would take further legal action against them in the High Court to restrain them from publishing the report, and would be satisfied with anything short of my complete removal from the report, because I was anything but what they were accusing me of doing. I've spent my life fighting racism, going back to the 1970s, actually putting my personal safety at risk, confronting fascists on the street in the 1970s, and indeed on building sites when I was a young apprentice bricklayer, when casual racism was quite a thing in the 1970s in the UK. And I would regularly challenge the casual racism that I heard at that time on building sites, and, you know, nearly got beaten up on more than a few occasions. So, you know, I'm not going to take any lectures from people who are bad faith actors and attempting to try and, you know, smear somebody, you know, with my record, and indeed somebody with Jeremy Corbyn's record, which is an unimpeachable anti-racist record, and yet he's being demonised in the way in which he speaks. Absolutely outrageous.
It really cannot be overstated how much the British media hate Jeremy Corbyn and have relentlessly attacked and smeared him during the last couple of years. I mean, to begin with, the vast majority of printed media in the United Kingdom is right-wing, okay? But even liberal left publications like The Guardian led the charge against Corbyn and smeared him relentlessly, and still are. Not even Ed Miliband or Gordon Brown or Tony Blair, the war criminal who destroyed Iraq, who has the blood of a million Iraqis on his hands, was smeared to this level by any of the mainstream media in the UK. Think of that. Think about how Bernie Sanders is smeared in the United States, except 100 times worse. Okay? Jeremy Corbyn has been called anything you can imagine. He's been called a jihadist sympathizer. He's been called a terrorist. He's been accused of wanting to abolish the monarchy and the army. He's been accused of a million things under the sun. So the mainstream media were not just complicit, they were more than happy to participate in this targeted smear campaign against leftists in the Labour Party, and specifically Jeremy Corbyn. It's not just conjecture, it's not just speculation or me saying that. This is actually backed up by raw data. A report by The Independent found that 75% of media coverage of Jeremy Corbyn was negative and factually misrepresented him. That is astonishing. For anyone to objectively say that Jeremy Corbyn has not been the target of a smear campaign by the Zionist lobby, by the political establishment in the UK, by the British media themselves, is utterly delusional and dishonest. But frankly speaking, these attacks don't just come from the Zionist lobby or from the British media, they also come from within the Labour Party itself. Even though Jeremy Corbyn won the leadership contest in 2015 by attracting a lot of new members to the Labour Party, a lot of youth with his anti-war message, with his populist message, this didn't change the fact that a lot of his colleagues in the parliamentary Labour Party are liberals, are Blairites, are to the right of him. They even tried to oust him in a coup, in a vote of no confidence in 2016. This vicious smear campaign by all of these actors is what contributed eventually to Labour's catastrophic loss a year ago in the 2019 elections. However, this witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn, against the left wing of the Labour Party, didn't stop after the loss of the election. When Keir Starmer took over, who again is a Zionist without qualification, as he says, and a former prosecutor and former British intelligence, when he took over, he continued to persecute the left wing of the Labour Party. He appointed a bunch of Blairites to his cabinet, and he interfered in what was supposed to be an impartial investigation. Starmer suspended Jeremy Corbyn not even 24 hours after his comments about the EHRC report. Again, Corbyn acknowledged there was a problem with anti-Semitism. He just said that it was blown up by the media, which is factually true. Keir Starmer suspended him, and last week when the National Executive Committee reinstated Jeremy Corbyn as a Labour member, Keir Starmer withheld the whip, meaning that Jeremy Corbyn is now standing in Parliament as an independent. So even though he's back in the Labour Party, he is not back in the parliamentary Labour Party. Chris, you were suspended from the Labour Party in 2019, very unfairly, I might add, and now Jeremy Corbyn as well. Do you feel there's been a targeted campaign against pro-Palestinian voices or anti-Zionist voices within Labour?
Most definitely. I mean, the Israel lobby is all over this. I mean, the two complainants to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission are out-and-out Zionist organisations, the so-called Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the self-styled Jewish Labour Movement, are both out-and-out Zionist organisations. And there is no doubt that that was the agenda to take out prominent pro-Palestinian voices. It was unconscionable to them to have someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who was an anti-imperialist, somebody who was very supportive and sympathetic to the cause of the Palestinians, somebody who had set his stall out to implement an ethical foreign policy were Labour to get into office, and indeed had appointed a shadow minister for peace and disarmament. They took out Ken Livingstone, who was a prominent anti-racist, probably somebody who'd done more for the cause of anti-racism than anybody, actually, any politician in Britain when he was leader of the Greater London Council and then the London Mayor. Absolute, solid anti-racist. He was one of the first high-profile casualties. And then people like Mark Wadsworth, a well-known black anti-racist who introduced Nelson Mandela to the Stephen Lawrence family and was very instrumental in you know, supporting the Lawrence family in getting some semblance of justice for their son. He was thrown under the bus. He was accused of being a bigot and anti-Semite. Somebody who's an out-and-out, you know, anti-racist. Jackie Walker, another vice chair of Momentum, a black Jewish prominent member of the party, an anti-racist trainer. She was also taken out then because we had a unique moment in history where we could have had a socialist government in Britain that would have transformed the economic landscape in Britain for British citizens and tackled the grotesque inequality, but also, more significantly, I think, in many ways, had an anti-imperialist foreign policy, a foreign policy that would have been incredibly sympathetic to and supportive of the Palestinian people and would have really held the rogue Israeli state's feet to the fire in relation to the way in which they're flagrantly disregarding their international law obligations and so on. That was unconscionable. That was what this was all about.
Why do you think they're going to such lengths if Corbyn's no longer the leader anyway and we've got Keir Starmer who's heading Labour now?
It's part of this maximalist strategy that they are absolutely keen to utterly crush any semblance of a kind of a progressive left inside the Labour Party or the Labour Party being a potential vehicle for an ethical pro-Palestinian policy and a socialist sort of corporate capitalist party. And what they're determined to do is to create a safe opposition, if I can put it like that, a party in Britain, which is essentially the flip side of the current government. You know, we've got two establishment parties that are two sides of the same coin. In the same way that in the United States we have the Democrats and the Republicans, which in reality doesn't really matter who gets into government. You know, nothing much changes, and that's where we're at in Britain now, and that's why I think we absolutely, in my opinion, need to, in Britain, be working to build an alternative movement and ultimately an alternative electoral vehicle, because I think the Labour Party is utterly broken. And what I've been saying is that the best thing we can do is to kill it and start again.
Two sides of the same coin. Overseas operations bill going through, spy cops bill going through, no opposition whatsoever from Labour. I mean, it's pathetic, it's grotesque. What is the future of the Labour Party? Is there one at all?
Look, Labour as a vehicle for socialism, as a vehicle for progressive change, it's over, it's finished. You know, Tony Benn, the great Tony Benn, great socialist, who best leader, best prime minister this country never had, used to talk about the new Labour cuckoos attempting to take over the Labour nest. Well, they've absolutely not just taken it over, they've absolutely destroyed it and broken all the eggs in the Labour nest. And it's impossible to put broken eggs back together. And we therefore need to, in my opinion, focus on building a new nest. But it won't be easy to build a new party. But it's not impossible. It's been done in the past. I mean, look, you know, back in the day, the duopoly system that existed in Britain, two-party system, was between the Liberals and the Conservatives, and then Labour broke through. You know, so it can be done. It can be done. And as I keep saying, you know, with solidarity, anything is possible, and you know, there are more of us than them at the end of the day, and we've just got to give people confidence that, you know, we can actually make a difference.
Thanks very much, Chris, for your time. Really appreciate you coming on. I have to say, I'm in complete agreement with what Chris said, with what Miko said. Unfortunately, the Corbyn experiment is dead. Whatever chance the Labour Party had of actually being a vehicle for anti-imperialism, being an anti-war movement, being a party that champions the rights of workers, that actually fights for Palestinians, is gone. It has been taken over once again by the liberal establishment, by the Blairites, who are now working in tandem with the Conservatives, with the Tories, to promote authoritarian, absolutely Orwellian policies, like the Overseas Operations Bill, which legalizes war crimes by British soldiers, or the Spy Cops Bill, which gives undercover government agents the right to commit crimes, any crimes. This is absolutely frightening. There is no more opposition party in the UK. And whatever chance there was at having one is also gone. This shows us once again the reach of the Zionist lobby and how far they're willing to go to silence pro-Palestinian voices and anyone who speaks out against their persecution and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, who exposes their war crimes. This should frighten anyone who actually cares about having a democracy and about fighting racism in all of its forms. And anyone who is denying that this was a political witch hunt, that this was politically motivated, that this was a targeted campaign against Jeremy Corbyn, against his allies, and against the true leftist and anti-imperialist wing of the Labour Party, is lying to themselves. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Beyond the starvation and malnutrition, war-torn Yemen has been the site of cholera epidemics and medical shortages so extreme and so long that some chronic illnesses like diabetes kill the bulk of those inflicted simply from going untreated too long. On top of that, Saudi airstrikes continue to kill large numbers of people, mainly civilians, and those strikes have fueled international outcry. Yet, no decisive action by the UN to force an end to the conflict and hold the Saudi-led culprits to account. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency. This article is published under the heading, "Yemen is Still Suffering." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The U.S.-backed and Saudi-led war on Yemen has been a disaster for its long-suffering people from day one. Some 6 years into the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen, the United Nations is reporting that 233,000 people have been killed, calling this unacceptable and demanding both sides work on an immediate ceasefire to the conflict. Though a lot of people have been killed directly in the war, UN figures show the majority of the civilian death were from airstrikes, as well as lack of food and medicine, diseases, and lack of other general infrastructure. That's not a surprise. Beyond the starvation and malnutrition, war-torn Yemen has also been the site of cholera epidemics and medical shortages so extreme and so long that some chronic illnesses like diabetes killed the bulk of those inflicted simply from going untreated too long. No one is really healthy in Yemen. There is not food and medicine for that, but the really sick probably already died from the lack of treatment. On top of that, Saudi airstrikes continue to kill large numbers of people, mainly civilians, and those strikes have fueled international outcry. Yet no decisive action by the UN to force an end to the conflict and hold the Saudi-led culprits to account. Meanwhile, the United States and its European minions continue to sell the Saudis so many bombs, which means they must also be held to account for this humanitarian catastrophe in The Hague. After 6 years, it's safe to debate that Saudi Arabia and its criminal allies failed to win the protracted war. This is an important sign that international pressure is building on the US and the Saudi coalition because of the many documented war crimes that they have committed in broad daylight. The call for ending the war is 6 years late, but it is nonetheless welcomed by the international civil society. Unfortunately, the war criminals ignore the call to end the war, just as they are ignoring the conditions set by the UN for an immediate ceasefire. The UN will have to do much more than that if they are going to force the US and NATO to cut off the Saudis and their allies, challenging their unlawful support that have only led to the killing of innocent men, women, and the elderly is the only sure way to do this. It is essential that the UN recognize that the war on Yemen is both abhorrent and illegal, and they must put a stop to it. Just as the way the senseless military campaign failed to restore Saudi Arabia's desired status quo throughout the region, it has also failed to serve US and Western interests. On the contrary, the murderous rampage has undermined US and Western security, bolstered Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and made many Western governments complicit in numerous war crimes. Their participation in the war has been a shameful and ugly affair that will go down as one of the worst policies in modern history. As maintained by the UN, however, there must be a sustained ceasefire right now in order to get the people and resources into Yemen that are necessary to stop the bloodshed and the famine. Under the circumstances, it is hardly surprising that the US government would be directly responsible if things continue to go from bad to worse in the winter. In this pandemic season of ours, the US government has put more effort into this war than any Western government. It has been out on the hustings in Saudi Arabia from early moments of the military campaign to sell the products of America's largest arms makers. And that the performance will never end under Joe Biden's presidency is beyond dispute. Now that Biden is slated to take office as the 46th president of the United States, he should address the most daunting problems first. Nowhere is there more at the stake than when it comes to how he should handle America's highly militarized foreign policy in the West Asia region, particularly in Yemen. At a time when the pandemic and the famine pose the greatest threats to the safety and security of the Yemeni people, ending America's support for the Saudi-led war should be considered as top priority. Unfortunately, the Pentagon regime and the arms industry have yet to get the message too. Instead, the big-ticket war profiteers continue to assure their partners in crime in Riyadh and elsewhere that the Biden administration may not significantly reduce the Pentagon regime's military interventions in the West Asia region. Just like their predecessors, the Biden administration will never end America's endless wars, much less provide an effective and humane solution to the problem of millions of desperate civilians in Yemen.
the news live.
Mati Sarkar! Mati Sarkar! Sanjukta Marcha! Sanjukta Marcha!
India has been the scene of mass anti-government protests since September. This after the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi introduced a reform bill, which was later passed into law, seeking to deregulate India's agricultural sector by setting a minimum support price, known as MSP, and allowing farmers to sell their crops to private buyers. Protesters, however, have a different understanding of the law. They accuse the government of Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party of aiming to benefit big corporations, leaving farmers at the mercy of a free market while they can sell crops at higher prices if the demand is there. They have called on all farmers to hold sit-in protests outside district offices throughout the country.
I think they wonder if the farmers say that they need minimum guarantee of income. Obviously, they have a point. That's my opinion. That they have a point in saying that we want minimum guarantee of income, otherwise we will suffocate and we will die.
On Monday, protest leaders and community organizers called for demonstrations to be held in all districts across the entire nation. They also intensified their agitation by calling on demonstrators to start a day-long hunger strike. In many of such events, protests have turned violent with police using military tactics, including water cannons and tear gas, against frustrated protesters to disperse them. Some were also beaten with batons. The law allows farmers to sell their produce outside government-controlled agricultural markets, which ensures prices wouldn't get too high. Modi says this will give farmers a chance to decide their own prices and sell directly to private businesses like grocery chains, which ultimately cut the traders and middlemen.
The amount of money that the farmers are going to lose is unbelievable, because if they allow these, what we call, free market enterprises to get into this place and get rid of the farmers, small industry farmers.
Yet several rounds of negotiations between the government and protest leaders have had no tangible result. The farmers want authorities to completely repeal the law. Even a written proposal to the farmers' union, which laid out a series of amendments, including written assurances over MSP, has not stopped farmers from calling off their protests. Farmers say the amendments are just part of cosmetic changes to the law and it does not really change its character. They say the only way left for the farmers is to continue their protests until their demands are met. Agriculture contributes more than 15% of India's GDP, making it the largest employment source and a significant piece of its overall socio-economic development. It has employed 49% of its total workforce, that accounts for more than half of the country's working population. According to Hindustan Times, from 2018 to 2019, the average Indian farmer earned 10,329 rupees, which is about $140 per month. Of more than 263 million workers, many solely rely on farming to put food on their table and roof over their head. Based on figures released by India's Ministry of Commerce and Industry, the country is the world's largest producer, consumer, and exporter of spices, producing nearly 70% of the world's spices. It is also the world's largest milk producer and the second largest rice and wheat producer after China.
Modi government doesn't realize that it's an agricultural economy that basically they have. But since they have progressed so much, they think that they are able to, what you call, get rid of those laws and give the industry, the so-called free market. In that doesn't work in case of this sort of situation as it is. The farmers say they want minimum guarantees. The Modi government is not able to, so far, is unwilling to give them those tools.
The crisis in the agricultural sector in India is nothing new, as the country has been suffering for decades. Things changed significantly in the 1960s when India went through the Green Revolution under then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, who implemented the growth of high-yielding wheat and rice crops to address famine in the country. The revolution marked the beginning of industrializing the agricultural sector and introduced new methods of fertilization and the use of pesticides, which negatively affected many farmers. Now with the new law, nothing can be guaranteed except growing inequalities and disparity among the Indian population. The crisis will also leave one of the world's largest economies in tatters.
The United States are quick to condemn other nations around the world on a whole host of issues, from political alignment to economic choices, yet it's on human rights that the US is the most hypocritical of them all, as federal inmates are being executed in a final purge prior to Trump's imminent departure. When Trump came to power, and in fact during both his election campaigns, he claimed that he would be a champion of the justice system, famously stating to Hillary Clinton during one televised debate that he would get her arrested. Yet with time ticking away before Trump hands over the reins to Joe Biden, the incumbent president appears to have gone on a federal killing spree, executing more prisoners since he's been in power than all other state executions combined, making him responsible for more executions than any other modern president. In 2020 alone, state-ordered executions totaled 7 across all 50 states of the US, yet Trump's federal executions have totaled 10, with 3 more inmates on death row due to be terminated prior to January the 21st, something that Trump will likely see out as the deadline approaches, potentially bringing the total to 13, almost double the amount of state executions. The decision by Trump to go on a final execution spree breaks with the norm, as traditionally, death row inmates are usually exempt from execution during a presidential transition period, allowing the incoming to consider clemency should the terms and conditions apply.
I think the number that we've seen from the Trump administration is astronomical compared to what we've seen from previous administrations combined. And so, especially by adding on some on top of what was already scheduled, I think it's clear that they're trying to rush the execution process.
But it seems that Trump is merely following the age-old US tradition of using the death penalty, as since colonial times, the US has executed over 15,000 people. Many of them had been later found to be not guilty due to technological advances, criminal investigations improving, and public opposition to the death penalty increasing. Naturally, the timing of the latest execution has raised the question as to whether this is genuinely a cause for justice, or is this simply Donald Trump playing God for one last time, showing the US and the rest of the world just what kind of man he really is. Trump has shown he's not shy when it comes to stirring racial hatred in the US. His mishandling of the Black Lives Matter movement was one of the key reasons he lost the presidential election to Joe Biden, leaving behind a country deeply divided along a racial line in the process. The sentiment is reflected in the US criminal justice system, especially on death row, as since 1976, only 21 white defendants have been executed for crimes against black people, yet 297 black suspects have been executed in the US for crimes on white people, clearly showing the system is racist to the core. Trump's also demonstrated a history of racist views, labelling the Black Lives Matter movement as a destructive entity, not designed to bring equality and justice to black people, but to bring the entire US infrastructure to a halt, something that's baffling to hear.
The stated goal of BLM organization people is to achieve the destruction of the nuclear family, abolish the police, abolish prisons, abolish border security, abolish capitalism, and abolish school choice. That's what their stated goals are. This is not the agenda of the black community. This is the agenda of an extreme socialist, or worse, you know what the other word is, yeah, Marxist, communist.
With Trump supporters clearly echoing the sentiments of the outgoing president, groups such as the Proud Boys and other far-right organizations are lapping up the attention and openly supporting a crackdown on black people, either through the use of police brutality or through the execution chamber, something that the US has a haunting history on when it comes to killing black people. Yet the situation may be about to change in the US, with President-elect Joe Biden stating that he is in fact against the death penalty, and should the conditions be met, he can end the act with a stroke of a pen. However, Biden, like many others before him, still has a lot to demonstrate that he can turn his words into actions.
Quote, "You won't be saving Joe Biden's America. And what's their proof? The violence we're seeing in Donald Trump's America. These are not images of some imagined Joe Biden America in the future. These are images of Donald Trump's America today.
What now remains to be seen is whether Trump's last stand will be to execute the three remaining federal prisoners prior to him leaving, and more importantly, whether the US now, and in the future, considers its own actions before criticizing others. Following his capture by Iranian intelligence agencies, Ruhollah Zam was brought to trial and executed for his management of the Ahmad news page on the Telegram application, a page that encouraged people in Iran to commit acts of crime against public infrastructure, institutions, and authorities. As a result, France, Germany, Italy, and Austria have all condemned the execution of Zam, and as an act of protest, have pulled out of an online business forum in Tehran, leaving the organizers of the event forced to postpone to a future date. Some of the items on the page administered by Zam included the incitement of terrorist acts in Iran, involving the building and use of petrol bombs, as well as actively guiding people when and where to protest, ensuring maximum attendance during the crime sprees fueled by Zam's instructions. Said Khatibzadeh, the spokesman for the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, has claimed that the statements and speculative comments delivered by the EU nations was hypocritical and devoid of any value, clearly showing that they were either ignorant to the facts or were simply choosing to ignore them. In response to the act, the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs has also summoned the German and French ambassadors to the MFA in order to present representations to the heads of missions, an act that demonstrates a clear message in diplomatic terms as to the gravity of the situation. So with Iran labelling Zam as a terrorist, why then has France, Germany and other EU nations sympathised with such a person, in particular when they were so aware of the true actions committed by Zam and his so-called news channel?
I believe that it's not difficult to show that principles of the European countries when crystallize themselves into a concrete political form, they become tainted with self-interest and hypocrisy. Speaking of moderation, however, where an official and a scientist in the Islamic Republic of Iran is assassinated by terrorist elements and then condemning punishment of a rebel and not journalist vowed to undermine Iran's national security is far from hypocrisy. Western countries' intelligence, media, financial, and diplomatic support of rebels whose goal is set for them to turn a country into rubble, to subvert a nation, is shameful and I think must be confronted.
What now remains to be seen is whether the EU will apply this logic across a broader screen and condemn the assassinations of senior Iranian figures by other nations, which again demonstrate more traits of terrorism against Iran that conveniently seem to be treated with silence. The Telegram application is like many other forms of social media, a tool that's used to send and share information around the world with friends, family and others. Although Zam's Ahmad News had over 1 million followers at its peak, it's unfair to label the channel as a media outlet. It's hence interesting to question the EU labelling Zam as a journalist, when in all reality he was nothing more than a tool of coercion, acting as an agent provocateur on behalf of various intelligence agencies. It also raises the question as to why the term journalist was used for a man who worked in liaison with the DGSE in France and Mossad, and openly bragged that after Emmanuel Macron, he enjoyed the highest levels of state protection in France, conditions which seem a little odd for just a journalist. Furthermore, why were the French so happy to host Zam, who, like the terrorist cult, the MEK, enjoyed the comfort and protection of living in France, in spite of being involved in heinous crimes, and accepted as a terrorist organization by many nations around the world?
Well, he is not a journalist. What's important here, I think Iran has learned its lesson. Today, 17,000 Iranian officials and people have fallen prey to assassinations and terrorist acts of MEK that have extensive support of diplomatically and financially from Western countries.
With the EU sitting on the fence with Iran across a host of issues, in particular when it comes to the JCPOA, is now not the time for the powers of Europe to recognise Iran's inalienable right to protect its national security interests, just as each European state does on its own, and at the same time show some level of consistency when it comes to recognising other people and groups like Ruhal Azam and the MEK, and concentrate less on the irrelevant non-state actors, condone the state-sponsored assassinations, and build a level and safe playing field for all.
Supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump protesting the outcome of the last month's presidential election clashed with counter-protesters in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. Police used pepper spray to break up the brawls that erupted between Trump's fervent supporters, Proud Boys, and Antifa counter-protesters. Four people who had sustained potentially life-threatening stab wounds were taken to hospital. Police also said 23 people were arrested.
There's a famous saying that during times of crises like this is when fascism starts to rise. And that's what we're seeing in the United States. We're seeing the rise of a far right, a very Islamophobic far right as well, that is anti-immigrant, that has hatred for people from the global south, that want to reclaim the United States as a white settler colonial state. Versus everyone else. Because Trump is no longer part of the equation, this right-wing radical base is becoming more violent, more of a threat, and people really need to be careful, because during times like this of crisis, we saw it happen in Germany, and you know, we're seeing something very similar in the United States.
The far-right supporters also rallied outside the U.S. Supreme Court, where retired Army General Mike Flynn delivered a speech. Flynn, who served as Trump's national security advisor for a brief period, was recently pardoned by the president after pleading guilty to lying to federal investigators during a probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Donald Trump cheered on the protesters. In a post on his Twitter account, the president celebrated the demonstration, which was a follow-up to the last month's much-publicized Stop the Steal rally. Those rallies also ended in violence, with pro-Trump and counter-protesters engaging in fights that left multiple people injured, including four police officers. The Proud Boys is a self-proclaimed Western chauvinist group whose ideology has been labeled as misogynistic, Islamophobic, and anti-immigration. Trump made controversy during presidential debates when he refused to condemn white supremacists, urging the far-right group to stand back and stand down.
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it. You want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and white supremacists and right
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by.
The group has claimed its members, usually carrying weapons and military gear, only use violence in self-defense. But some of the group members have been convicted of committing violent crimes against counter-protesters. Donald Trump is continuing his attempts to maintain power, even though federal authorities greenlit U.S. President-elect Biden's transition late last month. His refusal to concede has fueled angry demonstrations by his most loyal supporters, drawing fierce opposition against the Democrats. This is expected to complicate matters for President-elect Joe Biden, who vowed to, quote, heal the divided U.S.
I think the fact that there's so much chaos going on in the United States right now, I think that Trump doesn't really care about the lives of innocent people. He doesn't care about the lives of the average working class person in the United States. What he cares about is fulfilling the interest of his lobby that helped him get elected into office. We're talking about the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, Israel, a lot of Zionists who are pushing all they can to escalate war against Iran right now.
Donald Trump took up office with his signature motto of Making America Great Again. 4 years on, the United States seems far from what Trump claimed to achieve.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to another episode from series of Q&A on Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. If you have been following this series of sessions and shows, we have been talking about different questions and misconceptions concerning some Islamic issues, and the respected guest speakers and guests of this show will try to provide us with some answers. Today, again, like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, researcher from Qom Seminary Schools, to answer the questions that we pose in this very session. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. The question that we want to start with, again, is continuation of our previous discussion, which was about the domestic violence. And we reached to this point that why, in some Islamic text, which is holy and sacred to us, like that of the Holy Quran, there are some verses that emphasize on beating the women, and we have been talking about that issue in our previous session. But our discussion, I think, did not lead to a comprehensive answer. Just we pinpointed to some factors and pinpointed to some answers which needs to be explained. The explanation that the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, provided in our previous session was that this beating that actually we find here does not mean that kind of beating that we actually imagine and have in mind. And this needs to be, inshallah, to be analyzed. And it is not the first, but the last way to be done. But there are some stages before leading to that beating stage. And the beating itself is different with what we, as I said, what we have in mind with beating. So inshallah we shall focus on this issue, and hopefully we shall finalize the whole discussion on domestic violence and the viewpoint of Islam. We have said that there is no way any congruity between Islam and domestic violence, and Islam is totally against domestic violence and any kind of violence. And in case there is a point or text that needs to be discussed, I think we have to refer to the sources and the reliable interpreters of the Holy Quran. Sheikh Murtada, I want to ask you to explain the verse that we started talking about more, please.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Firstly, let me correct one phrase in your words. You said that there are verses, there are not various verses.
Very true. There is only one verse. Yeah. Thank you very
Chapter
much.
Chapter An-Nisa, verse 34. This is the only case in which, according to some people, beating women has been mentioned. So we also said that there are many narrations preventing men from beating their wives. And very as true. You rightly mentioned, there are three steps. Now, the verse, as I mentioned, talks about the desertion and rebellion of women. Again, I need to repeat that rebellion can be done by men as well. But in that case, women go to Muslim authorities and the Islamic courts, and they will follow up the suit, and they will admonish the men. They will, if needed, punish the men, and so on and so forth. So we shouldn't think that rebellion is only practiced by women and men do these steps. No, it can be done by men. But because of the fact that usually women are not able to fix this problem, they need to go to the Islamic authorities and Islamic courts so that they fix the problem through different ways. It could be, again, through admonition, or if it's not useful, then the other steps, even prison and so on and so forth. So as you rightly mentioned, there are three steps. First of all, to admonish them, and I mentioned in the first program that it should be done in the best possible way. In most of the cases, it would help. It would solve the problem. And again, in many cases, men are not able to act upon this step. In that case, they have no right to go to the second and the third steps. They have to ask other people who are the most qualified people to do and act upon this step, which is admonition. So we can say that if not in almost all the cases, in most of the cases, the problem would be solved through admonition. The second step was that to be away from the lady in the bed, talking about the sexual desires, and finally, wadribuhun. Now, as I mentioned in briefly in the previous programs, there are two points regarding the word wadribuhun. The first point mentioned by some of the Islamic researchers is that the root daraba has at least two meanings in the Noble Book of Quran. One of them is beating, and the other is leaving one place to another.
Very true.
It has been mentioned in another verse in the Noble Book of Quran. In that case, the word darb has been mentioned, and in that verse, the word darb means to go from, for example, one city to another city, or from one region to another region. And it's not something mentioned in the Quran only. No, when you refer to Arabic dictionaries, the root daraba has at least these two meanings. So these researchers, they believe that unlike the assumptions of many Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, wadribuhunna has nothing to do with beating at all. It may refer to leaving the house, for example. So the second step was leaving the bed. The third step might be leaving the house for a while so that that rebellious woman would, recover her conditions and think about the issue, and then be away from that rebellion and ill conduct. This is one opinion, and we have to take into consideration this opinion. At least there is such possibility, especially when we take into consideration all those narrations which prohibit men from beating women. But if we translate it as most of the scholars believe, we are not ignoring the fact that most of the scholars, they translated the word wadribuhunna to refer to beating. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that to understand the true meaning of the verses, you have to refer to Prophet who explained you the meaning of the verses. إِنَّا أَنزَلْنَا إِلَيْكَ الذِّكْرَ لِتُبَيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ So the job of tabyin and explaining the verses is upon the Prophet, and by the same token, by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. And it has been mentioned in the narrations that beating should be very, very light, so much so that even the skin of women should not be red. I cannot imagine how it is possible with today's standards and criteria, if you can imagine. So it refers to a very light type of beating. For sure, there should not be any wound or leading to any kind of injury in the woman. I mean, before that, it shouldn't also lead to the skin to be and to become red.
Yeah. So, Sheikh, there is a question here that might come to the mind, that we have either two ways. One, to accept that soft, actually, interpretation of it, that beating has been interpreted as leaving the place, or accepting the beating itself. In case of the beating, in case, again, we go for the sort of interpretation that you have presented with that hadith of the Holy Prophet, the prophetic narration, then in case it's not going to harm a person, so how can it actually bring about a sort of change in the behavior, mm-hmm. then? So beating should find its meaning in order to bring a change. So in case, for example, it seems to be like, for example, playing with somebody just to beat on her hand while it does not even affect her. Can you please shed some more light on this issue, because it is a little bit vague to us still. Yeah.
Some scholars, for example, it's been mentioned in the tafsir book of Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi, they believe that this way of light beating might be applicable to a group of women. Psychologically speaking, some women, even if you slap lightly on their hand, for example, without the skin becoming red, it would cause a kind of change in their mindset. Mm-hmm. According to, for example, this great scholar, he believes that in some cases, at least, it is a way, it is a solution. I mean, a lady that always receives affection from her husband, mm-hmm. She doesn't receive any kind of violence because it's absolutely prohibited in Islam. According to Islam, she is a good-smelling flower, and now suddenly she received this very light version of beating. So at least in some cases, she doesn't, I mean, when you're talking about Islamic lifestyle, the women should be respected with the utmost respect. And now suddenly, she received this new behavior from her husband. It's very light, but it wasn't expected by that lady. She received that very light beating.
But this is not the first step, because she has already actually practiced being away in bed with the man, because the first step was to leave
but
her.
But it was not physical. I mean, mm-hmm. physically speaking, she didn't receive any kind of punishment, if we may put it punishment at all. So before that, it was only emotionally speaking.
Very true.
They were away from each other emotionally speaking. But physically speaking, according to this explanation, this very light physical punishment might change the mindset of the
supposedly
rebellious ladies.
This beautiful interpretation of yours is accepted, then do you think we can actually inject this beautiful interpretation in the minds of all the Muslims, that okay, Islam believes so in your behavior with your wife, won't it lead to more severe sort of behavior from the men's side? I mean, that can it be under control then, that to actually to make them understand, to make the men understand that this verse of the Holy Quran means this very sort and, let's say, light contact with your wife?
Let me give you an example to answer your question. We have some verses in the Noble Book of Quran about fighting the infidels. Mm-hmm. Now, Shia and Sunni's understanding of these verses is very clear.
Sure.
I mean, when you are attacked, then you are allowed to fight back. But ISIS understanding is completely different. They are permitting themselves to kill innocent women, children, Muslim, non-Muslims, and so on and so forth. And they claim that we are acting upon the Noble Book of Quran. Now, can we say that the Quran should not mention those verses because these, I mean, closed-minded people are taking and going to the extremes? No. The verses are giving us the true solutions, and it is the duty of the scholars to explain the verses by the help of the narrations and so on and so forth, and it is the duty of all the Muslims to know the Islam as it is. So if some ignorant men, they are not acting upon these verses, it's not the Quran should not be blamed. They very should true. Be blamed, or the scholars who have not acted upon their duties.
Very beautiful reasoning that you have actually brought up here, but unfortunately this close, I mean this small, simple-minded and close-minded people distorted the beautiful image of Islam in the world, that they actually, in some countries, they know Islam as terrorist because of these wrong and, let's say, close-minded people. That's why I was a little bit worried about the kind of understanding of the man on this issue. Thank you very much, Sheikh.
My pleasure.
So, Sheikh, can we wrap up the whole discussion on domestic violence and the viewpoint of Islam? And alhamdulillah, we reached to this conclusion that by violence and domestic violence, Islam has no way any relation with domestic violence and even prevents Muslims from doing any sort of violence against their wives. Even as the Sheikh said very beautifully, even we have some duties in facing even the enemies, the infidels. So Islam is the religion of peace. So is there any other point to be mentioned, Sheikh, here?
Yeah, the last point is that sometimes domestic violence is practiced by men because of their wrong assumptions of the responsibilities and duties of women inside the house, like cooking, like cleaning the house, and doing all the duties regarding the children, and so forth, and so on and so forth. Islam has come to reform this attitude. First of all, Islam invites the men to help the ladies, their wives, in house chores. We have many examples in the life of the Prophet, Imam Ali Salam, and other imams who help their wives. And second of all, to begin with, what we and many people think as duties of women, to begin with, they are not the duties of women. Of course, we are not inviting women to get rid of cooking, washing, and cleaning the houses, and so on and so forth. But Islam says that, I mean, again, to begin with, these are not the responsibilities of women. Of course, they are highly rewarded for doing them, but men should not expect their wives to do these responsibilities. And in some cases, these wrong expectations lead to domestic violence.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. And it was quite informative session, at least for me. I hope that the same. I hope the same for all the respected listeners. Inshallah, we shall get back to you with some other questions or, let's say, misconceptions that actually are mentioned about the Islamic issues in our upcoming session. I'd like to invite you to join us then. Till then, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا
In the limelight.
A new report highlights 2021's most pressing humanitarian crises and perhaps no surprise to many, victims of U.S. wars and regime change efforts top the list. The International Rescue Committee yearly report on the world's most pressing humanitarian situations